I like the story about the missionary who was down in Brazil, and he ran a camp right near what is called the Parana River. I assume you're familiar with piranhas. I have a little piranha, not alive. It's encased in plastic. It was a living piranha at one time. Missionary gave us when we were in Venezuela a number of years ago at a missions conference. And it does have sharp little teeth, lots of sharp little teeth. And this is called the Parana River down in Brazil. And on days when the temperature would reach 120 degrees, they didn't have pools like many of you might have in your backyards or community swimming pools. And so there was the temptation to want to swim in the Parana River. But he feared piranhas. And so he asked some of the locals about the possibility of swimming in the Parana River, if there were piranhas there. And one of them, several of them said, well, you know, you really don't have to worry about the piranhas here in the river because they only bite when they swim in schools, and they don't swim in schools here. And so the missionary, taking that advice, decided for the rest of the summer that he would enjoy times each day in the Parana River, which he did. And then later on, towards the end of the summer, he heard the story about a local fisherman who'd gone fishing out in the Parana River, and he fell out of his boat, and they never found his body. And he began to wonder, perhaps, did the piranhas eat his body? Again, they assured him, oh, no, around here the piranhas never bite because they only bite when they swim in schools, and they don't swim in schools here in this part of the river. And finally, the missionary wisened up. He said, why don't they swim in schools in this part of the river? And one of the locals said, because of the alligators. Well, Paul sort of had his piranhas and he had his alligators. He was the proverbial joke years ago I told, and if you're over 50, you probably don't remember it, so you'll enjoy hearing it again. For those of you that have heard it the first time, you'll want to go around and kind of repeat it this week. But, you know, there's the story, the old story about the two fried eggs in the monastery as they're about to be finished. And the one fried egg looks at the other, they're in the monastery kitchen, looks at the other in the pan, he says, you know, it's out of the frying pan and into the fryer. We had a group from College Station that laughed about 5 minutes later last night when the service, so you may, the Christian life is really a lot like riding a roller coaster. Have you noticed that? There's a lot of ups and downs. You're not always up and you're not always down. And the thrill of riding a roller coaster is because there are ups and downs. And the thrill in the Christian life comes from the fact that you're not always going to be on a high mountaintop. Sometimes you're going to be down in the valleys, and that makes the mountaintops all the more enjoyable. But there's a thrill in it. And there are times, at least for me, when I'm on a roller coaster, and I really don't ride them anymore unless I have to, my wife insists, because she loves him, but there are times when I'm on that roller coaster and I'm saying, Lord, if you just get me out of this last turn, I'll never ride the roller coaster again. It really is a lot like life, isn't it? In fact, Paul really described life that way in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 8, he says, we are hard pressed on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed. We don't know which way to go. We are perplexed, but not to the point of despair. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. We are cast down, but not destroyed. Or as one translation puts it, we are knocked down, but not knocked out. We may have the breath knocked out of us by life's experiences, but we're not knocked out. Paul had a certain resiliency in his life that came not from within himself, but came from the living Christ within him and the relationship that he had with Jesus Christ. And here's one of those experiences in Paul's life where he literally had the spiritual wind knocked out of him. It was a major crisis in his life. And I don't say that to in any way exaggerate, because later on we're going to see this morning in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 that this was a particular time in Paul's life that was most difficult, when the very life seemed to just be sapping away from him, crushed. Maybe you've got something in your life that's causing you to respond that way. Look at the background here in verse 22. Paul's in Asia. when this riot broke out. Whether or not he was in Ephesus right at this time, we don't know. Certainly he was later here. But again, the words translated literally here, when there was no small stir, a great commotion about the way, about Christians. Christians were the focal point of the problem, and they were known as people of the way because they were people who knew the way. They knew the way, the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. They knew him, so they became known as people of the way. That's how they're designated here in the book of Acts, those of the way. And there was a great disturbance, a great commotion here. This is the same word that Luke uses only one other time in the book of Acts. In fact, it's only used twice in the New Testament, this particular word. Derivation of this word is used in the Gospels, the troubling of the water in John chapter 5. But back in Acts chapter 12 and verse 19, when the soldiers discover in the morning that Peter was no longer in prison and they were responsible for guarding him, they knew they had a problem. And when morning came and they saw that Peter was gone, Luke writes, and in the morning when they discovered that Peter was not there, there was no small stir among the soldiers, meaning there was a great problem. They were in heap big trouble. Now that's where Paul and his companions were here. They were in heap big trouble. It was something that kind of came upon them rather quickly. They were just sort of caught in the middle of it. They were carrying out the commands of Jesus Christ in their life. They were being faithful to him, and all at once they find themselves in a boiling pot, cauldron, that was about to destroy them. You felt that way? Man, I've been trying to be faithful to Jesus Christ. Seems like everywhere I turn, I've got trouble. That's a Christian life. I thought of this a couple of months ago when I went out running on one of those mornings on the golf course when we had one of those very rare thunderstorms that just moved quickly through the area. We didn't see a lot of it. Most of us kind of forgot what rain was like until recently. But the skies were real ominous, and I thought, oh, I've got time to go out and put in 30 or 40 minutes of running. So I took off, and as I began to run, all at once, the sky just grew darker and darker and darker to where it almost looked like we were in the midst of the tribulation, you know, as it's described in Revelation. And I saw golfers beginning to kind of scurry for cover, and there were a few raindrops, and you could sense something dramatic was about to happen. And all of these golfers had gathered underneath this railroad underpass, maybe 10 or 12 golfers, and they're all kind of huddled under there. And I go running right past them. In the process, I kind of smart off and I say, ah, you bunch of chickens, you're just fair weather golfers. And they said a few things. I mean, they were friendly. But I literally didn't get probably another 100 feet beyond when all at once, the direction I was going, there was a flash of lightning that cut down through, I don't know how far away it was, but the thunder was almost immediate after it. And I'm telling you what, it got my attention. And I headed for the nearby men's room, and for the next 15 to 20 minutes, I was huddled in this men's room as the only non-golfer there with about 12 other men. Great time. I got a chance to witness about the power of God, by the way. But it came so quickly, and the hail, and the rain, and the thunder, and all at once it was gone, but it just sort of happened. And all we could do was ride it out. And that was Paul in Ephesus. All he could do was write it out. You got something going on in your life right now, you say, it's really out of my control. All you can do is write it out. Now, what are you going to learn in the process? There is something that God wants each one of us to learn. When we find ourselves caught up in circumstances that are beyond us, out of our control, we didn't have anything to do with it. Or even if we did, all at once the consequences of our actions, we can't control it. What are we going to learn? Let's look at four individuals here that the Spirit of God, through Luke the writer, wants us to focus upon. And I'm just going to touch upon the first three because I really want to get to Paul. But notice first the first man, Demetrius. Notice what motivates him. verse 24, for a certain man, here was the culprit behind what was happening to Paul and his companions, a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. Here was a man that was concerned about a very lucrative trade that was bringing him and his companions great profits. Because, you see, they were involved in the making of silver shrines, replicas of the great temple of Diana, or Artemis as it is in the Greek, but Diana in our English translations. And this temple, this goddess, this temple that was made in honor of this goddess where she was worshipped, was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It stood in the city of Ephesus. And the remains of that temple are still standing there today, couched between two hills, overlooking the great city of Ephesus, which had about 250,000 people in it at this particular time in history. And she was the focal point of commercial and religious life in Ephesus. Tradition tells us that she was, verse 35, you notice that he mentions here that this temple guardian, the great goddess Diana, the image which fell down from Zeus, many believe that there was some kind of a meteorite shower and that this one particular meteor resembled a multi-breasted woman, so she would become the goddess of fertility. And this was Artemis. And a whole religious kind of movement gathered around the worship of this great goddess Artemis. And they were making tremendous profits off of the trade. They were making these silver replicas of the temple. And you see, every spring they would have a big festival in honor of this great Greek goddess of fertility. And people from all over Asia would come, and in the process of being there, as we have in our own society today, they would have all kinds of souvenirs and trinkets to sell that would be made out of silver. And the really hot item was a silver replica of the temple of Artemis. And so Paul came preaching the gospel into this kind of a climate, into the city of Ephesus, and he's saying there are no gods that are made by human hands. There's only one true God, one living God, and he's the one that I'm proclaiming to you. And naturally, that became a threat to their thriving business. And Demetrius here is most concerned. He wants to do something about it. By the way, this temple measured 430 feet long, longer than any football field. It was 160 feet wide. It was considered, as I said, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And the discovery of this long-buried temple is one of the major epics in archaeological research. Everything that's been unearthed in the city of Ephesus simply verifies and authenticates the accuracy of this word of God. If you're here this morning and you're wondering, well, Steve's preaching, he's preaching from the Bible, but what authority does the Bible really have? This, my friends, can be verified archaeologically, that every major discovery in that part of the world has simply verified the accuracy of the biblical accounts as we have them. And many of us, Lord willing, next month are going to be able to go to the city of Ephesus, and we're going to see the remains of that ancient temple. And we're going to see the theater in which they gathered here later on in this passage that seated some 24, 25,000 people. It's all been unearthed. The Bible always is authenticated, substantiated by archaeological discovery. And so these who are at the heart of the problem are members of the way. But the real issue behind this is in verse 24, where Demetrius now is concerned because all of these silver shrines of Diana, they were bringing no small profit to the craftsmen, and now they were being hit in the pocketbook where it really hurts most men the most, in their ability to make not only a decent living, but a great living. Reminds me of the man who looked quite downcast and gloomy, and someone asked him, well, what's your problem? He said, well, he said, I'm a millionaire. Man says, well, that's great. I mean, what's so bad about being a millionaire? And he said, my wife has just made me a millionaire. He said, well, that's even greater yet. What's wrong then? Why are you downcast and gloomy? He said, because I used to be a multimillionaire. And these men used to make tremendous dividends, reap great profit from their trade. But because of the impact of Paul and the ministry of the gospel, all at once their trades now were beginning to taper off. And they didn't sell the same number of silver shrines that they'd sold the year before. The impact of the gospel was making great strides here. And that's brought out in these verses. He spells out the threat of Paul and his ministry in verse 27. Look where he says, so not only is this trade of ours in disrepute, in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple. These two things, our trade and the temple, we've got to protect them. We've got to do something about it. And the more he spoke about it, all at once he began to whip the crowd up into some kind of a frenzy where now there is a mob scene that develops rather quickly. Notice what happens. Verse 28. Now when they heard this, they were full of wrath, that is the people, and they cried out saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. Megali A. Artemis Ephesion is what they're saying. Great is this Diana of the Ephesians. And the whole city was filled with confusion. And they rushed into the theater with one accord, having seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, Paul's travel companions. Now try to get this scene in your mind. It would be sort of like someone coming to our beloved Riverwalk in Alamo and saying, we're going to tear down the Alamo. Some of you that have been long-term citizens of San Antonio, you appreciate the Alamo for different reasons than maybe others. We all appreciate what happened at the Alamo, and it has become in many ways a sacred spot, not only in Texas, but in American history because of what happened there. And so all at once people come in and they say, they become a threat to the Alamo or to the Riverwalk. Met a fellow, by the way, this morning who's just come down to the Hyatt here looking for a church home, he and his family. And he said the Hyatt down here on the Riverwalk is the number one Hyatt hotel in the country. Major attraction, tourism. And if someone was to come in and undermine the Alamo or the Riverwalk and all that's going on down there, naturally, there are many of you even this morning that have trades or incomes that are somewhat dependent perhaps on tourism. You just join forces like the rest of them. And we'd all come together in the Alamo Dome. And those that didn't fit in the Alamo Dome, they'd be standing outside. And that's the scene that we have here. They're all coming together down at the end of the Arcadian Way, which was a beautiful marble-covered street that led from the temple down to the theater, and the remains of all of that are there today. And they gathered in the temple. Mob scene develops very quickly. They grabbed Paul's companions along the way in verse 29. They kept Paul out of it in verses 30 and 31. Some cried one thing, some another. According to verse 32, there was just a state of confusion. Back a number of months ago, all of us pastors went to the Promise Keepers Pastors Conference in the Georgia Dome. One of the things I'll never forget, I don't remember who the speaker was, but 42,000 plus men with a few women, pastors sprinkled in, were asked by this speaker to do this. He said, at the count of three, I want all of you men to shout your denominational affiliation. So at the count of three, all 42,000 plus men shouted their denominational affiliation. Bill Coase was sitting next to me. I could not even make out what Bill said. Total confusion. And then the same speaker said, all right, at the count of three, I want all of you men to shout out who your Lord is. And at the count of three, all of them shouted out who their Lord is. And it was as clear as a bell, Jesus. Jesus. And he made his point. Jesus is the one who unites us and brings us together. Most of them, Luke says, writing here with his Greek what some call ironical sense of humor. He said most of them didn't even know why they were there. Look there in verse 32. He says most of them didn't even know why they come together. Isn't that the way a mob scene is? They don't even know why they've come together. Only a few really know the essence of the problem here. Most of them didn't even know why they come together. Now that introduces us to the second man, Alexander. There's a large Jewish population in Jerusalem, or rather in Ephesus. And they were concerned that they were going to get caught in the crossfire, that something was going to happen to them, there'd be another Jewish pogrom or persecution. And so they want to defend themselves and say, hey, wait a minute, we're innocent. But there was one thing that the Jews had in common with the members of the Way, Christians, and that is that they too believe that there are no such things as gods that are made by human hands, that there's only one true living God. And so they realized that they were in danger themselves. So they appointed a man by the name of Alexander who would go before this great crowd of a people, some 24, 25,000 in this theater, with absolutely perfect acoustics. And he would address them. So he held up his hands to address them. But the minute that they saw he was a Jew, they wanted nothing to do with listening to this man. So they shouted him down. And for the next 2 hours, 25,000 people are crying out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Look at verse 34. With one voice, they cried for about 2 hours. Can you get this picture in your mind? This mob scene crying out, over and over again, "Great is the goddess Diana of the Ephesians." It's out of control. It's a major storm. Max Lerner wrote in The Unfinished Country, he said, "Every mob in its ignorance and blindness and bewilderment is simply a league of frightened men that seeks reassurance and collective action." They kept on crying out the same phrase, prompted by the sight of this hated Jew. Now that brings us to the third man. The third man is this city clerk down in verse 35. And when the city clerk, who would be equivalent to our modern day mayor, see all correspondence to the city of Ephesus would be addressed to this city clerk, the mayor, this man, highly respected, most powerful man in the city of Ephesus. And he realizes that they've got a mob scene on their hands. They've got a problem, as the crowd has continued now for 2 hours to shout, "Great is the goddess Diana of the Ephesians." And he senses that things are out of control. And so he tries to calm the crowd in this way. Look in verse 35. "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know that the city of Ephesians is the temple guardian, the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Zeus?" What he's saying is, hey, it's a given. Why are you shouting, "Great is this goddess Diana," for 2 hours? It's a given. We all know she's a great image. She's a great goddess. Kind of reminds me, as I think of this, of bumper stickers, you know. I love my husband. Or I love my wife. Now, we don't have them on our vehicles. And one of the reasons we don't is because I said, well, that would be a given. I love my wife. I don't have to tell the world on a bumper sticker. It's just a given. And when every time I see that, I sort of read beyond that to I love my wife to, don't I? Don't I? Or I love my husband, don't I? Tell me I do. I should. No, he says it's a given. This is a given here. Everybody knows how great this woman is. So this leads to his words in verse 36. "Therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly. For you brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples." They haven't robbed any temple. They haven't taken any of your trade, nor blasphemers of your goddess. They've said nothing against her, only the fact that they say there's only one God. And yes, that created a problem. But notice in verse 38, "Therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls or judges. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined in the lawful assembly." Why? "For we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar, there being no reason which we may give to account for this disorderly gathering." Now you see, Ephesus was one of the few cities in the Roman Empire that was called a free city. Meaning that the Romans said, listen, you folks can have your own administration, you can have your own authority in Ephesus, and as long as you keep everything in control, then we will not give you the stiff arm of Rome. We'll take a hands-off policy. But if you cannot govern your people, if your people get out of control, then we are going to move in there with our authorities, and we will take over your city. And that's why the mayor of the city realized, we got to get this thing under control. Verse 41, when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. Now, Paul is the silent person here, you know, almost a silent presence. You hardly even see Paul in this passage. You may even wonder if he was there. Yeah, he was there. But they would not let him go into the theater. But this experience, and I want you to switch over to 2 Corinthians chapter 1 as we pull all of this together in the next 5 minutes. And I want you to see here some lessons that Paul learned from this experience that he said was an experience that nearly crushed the life out of him. There are two other passages in which I believe he refers to this experience at Ephesus. Number one, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 32, you need not turn there, but that's the great chapter on the resurrection of Christ and all of the great blessings and the hope that we have because of his resurrection. But then he says in verse 32 of 1 Corinthians 15, if in the manner of men I have fought with beasts at Ephesus, then what advantage is that to me? Now we know that when Paul speaks of being fighting with beasts at Ephesus, that Paul was a Roman citizen, and therefore he could not, as a Roman citizen, be cast to the beasts, the wild animals, as many other Christians were who were not citizens of Rome. And so when Paul is speaking of beasts here, he's speaking of wicked, evil men who threatened his very life and were fighting him as wild animals in Ephesus. In fact, Plato, the Greek philosopher, likened the mob to wild animals. And so we believe that Paul was referring to this experience. But then when you get to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, and verses 8 through 10, in this entire passage, he's talking about this experience, this affliction, this incredible problem that nearly cost him his life while in Asia, even though he doesn't mention Ephesus, he does mention Asia. Now look at verse 8 of 2 Corinthians 1. For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble, our affliction. And the idea here is of extreme stress and distress in our lives that came to us in Asia. That we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despaired even of life. What he is picturing here is a beast of burden, like a donkey that's weighed down so heavily that donkey is being crushed to the very ground beneath it. It cannot bear up underneath that load. Do you feel that way this morning with the load that God has allowed to be placed on you? Crushed, even to the point of despairing of life. In verse 9, yes, we had the very sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death. Yes, and I am confident, does deliver us, in whom we trusted, he will still deliver us. Three things that Paul learned from this experience that nearly crushed the life out of him. Number one, he experienced something of the comforting power of God. And that's why he writes in verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort, who comforts us. One of the great paradoxes of the Christian life is that we experience the grace of God, and the grace of God is more manifested in times of affliction and difficulty than it is in good times and prosperity. I heard Dr. Steve Ramos 2 weeks ago, and you know the story and how Yoli went to be with the Lord. And in that experience, Steve, as he was in the funeral home, speaking before the rest of his family, and he spoke of the incredible presence of the grace of God in his life and the life of his family. And not to be angry with God, that God had given Yoli as a gift to the family, and now he had taken Yoli back, but they experienced the grace of God, and Yoli and the family members and Steve experienced the grace of God in the midst of all of it. And that's the way it is. If you've been there, if you've gone through the death of a loved one, or if you've gone through extreme difficulties in your own life, you look back on that experience, you say, you know, there was something about God's grace that was so evident then that I don't sense His grace now. But it's there when we need it. Paul said, I experienced the comforting power of God. Secondly, he learned that through that experience, it only enhanced his ministry. Now he was able to comfort others, look in verse 4, with the same comfort wherewith he had been comforted of God. I find in my position as a pastor, and I'm very fortunate to be a pastor of this congregation, because there are so many of you that are involved in working with people, and you have a heartbeat for Christ and a heartbeat for the ministry, and I thank God for you. And I'm finding that in my position, one of the best things that I can do when people are hurting, and I was able to do it this week with a man who, when I talked to him on the phone, all he could do was cry. And I couldn't quite identify with his problem because my wife has never left me. And as I listened to that man sob on the phone, the best that I could do was say, I know another man who has been through this recently, and he will be able to hurt with you and identify with you and feel your pain in a way that I cannot. And I just simply put them together. Why? Because that's the way God has ordained it. We experience comfort in order that we might be able to comfort others. And finally, Paul learned in verses 8 through 10 that God is able to deliver. He was to the point of having the very life crushed out of him, and yet he experienced the delivering power of God. And when you get to that point in your life where you are involved in circumstances that are beyond your control, you have nothing that you can do, you have no strings that you can pull, no resources that you can use to be able to get you out of that situation, then you will learn that God is in control even though it's out of your control. And once you have learned that, my friend, you will have learned, I believe, one of the most valuable lessons in life. When the circumstances are such that you can no longer trust in yourself and in your ability to get you through, but rather His power, then you have learned an invaluable lesson of life. We were talking about that this week with our new church budget, which all of you as members adopted last week, and it's a hefty jump in our church budget with all of the expanding ministries. And every year for the last 24 years, I've looked at that and I've said, how in the world are we going to do it? We can't do it. There's no way that we can do it in the flesh. I don't see the way. But I know that God is able. And we've seen how God is able to provide. And I believe that there ought to be circumstances in your life, and whether it's in your finances or some other area, that you've got to trust God. You've got to step out in faith and say, you know, this is an area that's out of my control. I can't do anything about it. I don't have any resources to be able to pull this off. It may even be in ministry. As you step out in faith, you say, I can't. But oh, He can. He can. And He will. And He uses all of us in the process to bring it about. You know, there's one other thing, and I just share this in closing. Paul is remembered, honored. We read his epistles. Major impact upon Western civilization and other civilizations as well. Demetrius, whose God was money, we have all but forgotten. Demetrius is not remembered. He's not honored. But Paul, whose master, whose reason for living was Jesus Christ, is remembered and has left a tremendous legacy. And man, I just say this to you this morning. If you're living for money, if you're only living to expand your own resources, to build a business, to build an empire, you're going to be forgotten when you're gone. But you let Jesus Christ become the master and Lord of your life, and you, like Paul, are going to be remembered. And the question I would ask you this morning is, what really motivates you? Who are you living for? I want us to bow our heads in prayer. There's a beautiful song that goes, He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added afflictions He addeth His mercy. To multiplied trials His multiplied peace. His love has no limit. His grace has no measure. His power has no boundary that's known unto men. But out of His infinite riches in Jesus, He giveth and He giveth and He giveth again. behind all of this morning is a relationship. Christianity is unique because it's not a religion, it's a relationship. Paul had a relationship with the living Christ. And I would not want you to leave this place this morning without establishing that same relationship with the Christ of history and the Christ of prophecy, the Christ of the past, the Christ of the present, and the Christ of the future. Jesus Christ living in your life and controlling you and seeing you through life circumstances that you cannot make it on your own. If you'd like to trust Jesus Christ this morning and know and have a relationship with Him and know that your sins have been forgiven, know that you're going to heaven when you die, you can know that. Maybe you'd like to just talk to someone this morning, have someone pray for you because you're going through some very difficult times and circumstances in your life are out of control. We would encourage you to come at the end of the service. Father, thank you for these moments. Thank you for your presence here. Thank you for the gloriousness of the gospel, the power of the gospel. May we go forth from this place today, not ashamed of the gospel, willing to take a stand, and even if it means a riot, but to realize that we're not standing alone, we're standing in your strength. We give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's stand.